Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Man, I am so excited for the show today here. As you can tell by the excitement surrounding our Montana Talks table here, we are at the Business Days at the Capitol event here in Helena for the Montana Chamber of Commerce. And one of the speakers that folks in this room are most excited to hear from today is sitting with us right now. He's going to be the keynote speaker in about 1 hour. We've got Nathan Newdorf, who is from Alberta, Canada, the Minister of Affordability and Utilities with the Government of Alberta. Minister, great to see you on the show. Thanks so much for being with us here this morning.
Well, it's a great pleasure. Thanks very much for having me on your show.
We were talking before we kicked off the show here about just this close relationship between the U.S. and Canada, especially Alberta and Montana. Family relationships, business relationships, agriculture, you name it. So much of a shared bond between Alberta and Montana.
It's so true. There's just way more trade than a lot of people realize. We do about $5.8 billion U.S. dollars every year of trade back and forth between Montana and Alberta. Another fact that a lot of people don't know in the States, over 50% of the oil that the United States imports every year comes from Alberta alone. More than Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Russia combined. All of those combined, Alberta's more. So really strong relationships.
I love your title here, Minister of Affordability and Utilities. Look, if we don't have energy, American energy, North American energy, how are we going to have affordability? It's so key to get both of these together.
It really is. And more in our society, we're realizing with electrification, all of those kind of things, electricity fuels everything we do. Your radio show is a prime example. But it used to be 100 years ago, it used to be if you didn't have water, you didn't have a business, you didn't have a town. Today, it's water and electricity, both utilities. We need that to survive, we need it to thrive, and we need it for business. So key points for affordability going forward.
Well, I'm really interested in hearing from you what you see continuing to happen between Montana and Alberta in particular, or the U.S. and Canada. I mean, a lot of us here in Montana really wanted to see that Keystone Pipeline get across the finish line. But I've heard rumblings that some more things may be in the works potentially on that front.
Yeah, well, we need to continue to work through these relationships. We know these are troubling times. Globally, you look around, there are some very real threats trying to be addressed by national governments around the globe. We want to make sure that these local relationships stay at the forefront, that our businesses rely on your businesses, your businesses rely on ours. And if we don't continue to talk through some of these challenging times, we can lose what we have 100 years or more of history developing. So we want to continue to work with you on that.
Yeah, you were telling me a $5.8 billion trade relationship here just between us, Alberta, and here in Montana. We're going to talk more right after this quick break with Nathan Newdorf, who is the Minister of Affordability and Utilities with the Government of Alberta. Stand by, back with Montana Talks live from Helena and Business Days at the Capitol right after this.
Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right, back to it here with the Minister of Affordability and Utilities with the province of Alberta, Canada, Nathan Newdorf, who is here with us at Business Days at the Capitol. Affordability. This, everybody is pretending to talk about affordability right now. Some of the same people who were responsible for these massive inflation spikes in these last few years here in the United States of America in particular. How do you see U.S., Canada, Montana, Alberta working together to address these affordability issues?
Well, for me, it really links back to that relationship we share on electricity, the intertie between Alberta and Montana, making sure that we can work together to collaborate. A lot of the natural gas, a lot of the oil products start in Alberta, come down for refining here in Montana, continue to grow and get shipped in other directions. We share electrons back and forth depending on who needs more at the time. electrification, as I said earlier, is a key part of the future. We just see it more and more of a demand for everything that we do in our lives. And making sure we have a strong system where we can help each other when we have weather like outside today. It's snowing here pretty good, so there's no solar or wind happening right now. We need that good old dispatchable natural gas or coal-fired electricity to make sure that we're keeping the lights and keeping people warm and safe.
Yeah, and frankly, on that front, I mean, a lot of these kind of climate activists who've made electricity so unaffordable for us in these last few years, even they're starting to wake up and realize, you know, the Bill Gateses of the world, the folks in tech, they're even realizing, wait a minute, we just need energy, period. We just need energy that badly. What stands out? What are some things that stand out to you with this Montana-Alberta relationship, business that's done cross-border, that's really interesting that a lot of Montanans might not think about?
Yeah, you know what? The trade relationship is based on common ideals and a lot of practical thinking. Like you just said, electricity, it's not just sustainability. It's about affordability and reliability. You have to have it. You can't have it there sometimes and not there other times. And that thinking goes right across from agriculture. We were talking earlier about the cattle industry. Meat goes back and forth across that border multiple times from before it hits the plate on somebody's dish, wherever that might be. And Montana, Alberta, we like to say we got some of the best beef in the world, and we're very proud of sharing that. The manufacturing sector, similar, energy sector, so many of these things that we've developed together over 100 years. Vacation rentals, we were talking about that earlier. Pretty sure whitefish, about 30% of it's owned by Albertans in different ways.
And frankly, you know, my dad grew up in whitefish. My great-grandparents are buried in whitefish. I took my pontoon out on Whitefish Lake, and some of the people that are still there are the Canadians that have been there for 40 years that you still know from 40 years ago, right? Now, it would be very undiplomatic of me, so I won't ask you the question about Alberta and the whole 51st state discussion, but the reason why Montanans, at least, just really get a kick out of the whole conversation being brought up is because they know that Montana and Alberta, we have so much in common politically, socially, economically, that's why Montana just get a kick out of the conversation whenever it's brought up. Because really, Alberta, you've got challenges like we do sometimes with our federal government, where you guys are in real Canada, we're in real America, and yet we got folks on the left coast and the east coast trying to shut us down sometimes.
Yeah, those are realities that we're facing in the global conversations and at national levels and international levels, but we'd like to bring it back to the practical levels here on the ground. We're neighbors, and we've all grown up with a lot of stuff going back and forth across the borders. We think the best path forward is working cooperatively, putting taxes and tariffs. They hurt people on both sides of the border. So conservatism and free trade, those are great ideals that we have to work through the nitty-gritty, make sure that it's fair, make sure that it's just, and make sure that we both have that chance to succeed. Because when Montana and Montonians are successful, so is Alberta, and so are our Albertans.
You know, as a Montana First guy, I saw recently where the Kalispell folks were doing marketing campaigns in Alberta. Hey, Canadians, come spend your money in America. And I'm like, you know what? I want Montana to have so much wealth with mining and timber and manufacturing that the Canadians are advertising down here saying, come spend your wealth in Canada. But the reality is we can have both, right?
We can have both, and we're very proud of. In 2025, there is only one province in all of Canada that saw an increase of tourists from the United States. Guess which province that is?
Alberta.
That was Alberta.
There we go.
I think it speaks to the strong relationship that we have. I think it speaks to the shared values that we have, and I think it speaks to the diplomatic approach that we've seen the governor of Montana, the premier of Alberta, both share, saying we can find a path forward working together. It doesn't have to be divide and conquer kind of thinking, and we're very proud of that. That's the reason I'm here, is to make sure that the chamber, the capital city here in Montana realized that Alberta really values the relationship that we've built over the last 100 years. We want to continue to invest in that. We want to continue to strengthen that. And that means we're here to talk, and we're here to share ideas, and we're here to work together.
The Canadians, total different topic altogether, do a ton of great work in the Caribbean. 20 seconds to go, the reaction to this big news about Nicolai Maduro.
Well, I think it just speaks again to the political uncertainty globally, and where we can't forget who our friends are. We've got a very strong history. We've got to work on our strengths.
Talk about the strength, though, of the Western Hemisphere once again in the North American continent, and increase in freedom potentially all across South America on the march. Pretty incredible. Great to have you so much here. Nathan Neudorf with Alberta, the minister out of Alberta. Great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Really appreciate being here.
All right. Back on.
From Mondakistan to the Flathead. Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right. Hey, we got another special guest joining us here on the show. Normally, he's a keynote speaker and a panelist at stuff like this as well, but I wanted to invite him in as a special guest right now, not just because he's a great guy anyway, but, man, we were just talking about energy issues and affordability issues and brought up Venezuela and more. Sonny Capiz is the head of the Montana Petroleum Association. Sonny, thanks for coming down and joining us on the show this morning.
You bet, Aaron. I appreciate you having me on, man.
It's good to see you. So, man, let's just start with the big Venezuela news. Nicolai Maduro. A lot of people don't realize, like, Venezuela was the crown jewel of the South American continent. I mean, one of the wealthiest nations on the entire planet. And then the socialists took over. And they came out to your farm. I've had friends that grew up in Venezuela that have shared these stories with me. They came out to your farm and they said, you know what, that John Deere tractor? No, you don't get to have those anymore. You got to use this Chinese tractor instead. And then they said, by the way, this isn't your farm. This is the people's farm. And they destroyed a lot of the agriculture in that country. They did the same thing with oil.
That's right.
There was a lot of American business partnerships down there.
Yeah, Chevron, most of the infrastructure paid by, you know, American consumers. They came in, nationalized that entire network and all the infrastructure. They just took it. It was a big deal. I mean, I guess it's not probably wide knowledge, but Venezuela is the largest proven oil reserve in the world. It equates for about 70% of the global oil reserves, about 303 billion barrels of reserve oil. So it's pretty serious. You know, historically, a lot of the U.S.'s refinement infrastructure is built for that heavy, sour Venezuelan crude. Somewhat similar to the kind of Permian Basin crude that we make in Texas. So it was a big deal when Chavez and Maduro kind of nationalized all that asset. So
yeah. So, like for example, if you've ever been to Fenway Park in Boston, Massachusetts, you know, it's an incredible baseball field, right? I remember seeing the massive Citgo sign right there.
Yeah.
Well, especially Boston, Massachusetts, I mean, that was symbolic of this big relationship between the U.S. and Venezuela. But basically, as I understand it, you know, the socialists took over Venezuela, and they basically stole directly from American oil companies. And Trump's working to get that back right now.
Yeah, it's the classic socialist nation story. You know, all these, you have very prosperous countries at one point because it's a capitalist society. You have industry come in, they make life better for everyone, good jobs, good wages, thriving industry. And then you have a country, you know, an ideology come in and say, oh no, we're taking it. And look what's happened, right? You have the largest proven oil reserve on the planet, 303 billion barrels a day. They produce about a million barrels a day. The U.S. produces 15 million a day. And, you know, our refined product, you know, they're probably exporting 500,000 barrels. We have single refineries that do 500,000 barrels a day. But that's what you get. That's what you get with mismanagement and a fundamental lack of capitalist ideology. You don't get production, and people suffer. And look at what's happened to the people of Venezuela. They've suffered because.
Oh, yeah. So one of the things that was kind of some of the early speculation was, okay, now with Nicolai Maduro being taken into custody by this incredible operation, what does that mean? Could these American oil companies go back in and not just recoup their investment, repair these relationships? But the initial speculation was, my goodness, there is still too much uncertainty with the rest of the government still in place. There is so much work that would need to be done to rebuild and repair all of that. But it sounds like you're actually hearing a little more optimistic speculation.
You know, I think you're looking at 5 to 10 years for them to get back up to peak operating capacity. The timeline of nationalization to now, the mismanagement has been so broad. The infrastructure upgrades alone will take that long to get them online. The reality is yes, it is the largest reserve on the planet, but they're less than 1% of the export market currently. It's just their situation is so bad that for this to have any true effect, especially on U.S. oil markets, it's going to be, 5 to 10 years probably.
Now, the other concern I would have is, okay, from an American producer perspective, like, Rockin' the Bakken, Montana oil and gas guys, North Dakota oil and gas guys. Okay, so if we get all this Venezuelan oil back on the market, although it's already been on the market, it's just being consumed by Russia and by China and Iran, et cetera. But does that potentially lower the price of oil so much to where American producers have to, scale back their investments? That's one question. The other question, before I forget it, is, one thing I know the Trump administration is doing is, instead of being so focused on what the price of oil is per barrel, make it easier, make it more efficient, make it less costly to produce that barrel of oil. And then you can A, lower the oil prices, lower the gas prices, but still keep American producers in the game because they're delivering it more efficiently and less costly.
I'll answer the first question. No, I don't think the Venezuelan oil influx is going to have much short-term price. I don't think it's going to mess with it too bad.
Because it's already there.
Yeah, and it's just frankly
dedicated to some third world tin pot dictator.
Exactly. It's going to take so much time for that infrastructure to get put in place to produce. And ultimately, the other thing is, the way it works really is it's like farm to market. I mean, our produced refined products happens sort of on a local level. Like, Montana has 4 refineries, right? And those 4 refineries are taking Canadian and local produced crude. And those refineries are making a product that is primarily getting sold in our region. Central and Eastern Washington, Idaho, Montana, the Dakotas, a little bit of Western Minnesota. I mean, it's going to local retailers. It's fueling our farm economy is what it is. And that's why they built these refineries here in the first place. That was where the main distribution offtake would be, right? It's the ag industry, railroads, et cetera. So it's kind of, on a very local level, I don't think there's going to be much effect because, our produced product is at a local level. The other thing is, like you said, the Trump administration is pushing, they want a cheap produced product. But ultimately, what we really need, more refining capacity.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you can have, the way economies of scale work is for it to be profitable to produce the raw product, there has to be a extremely large takeoff network to take that raw product to turn into consumer product. So more refining capacity means they can take more produced oil and still make it economic.
Could we be on the cusp of that finally once again happening in America where we've got the Trump administration in place here in Montana, we've got, a solid red majority legislatively, the governor's office. The challenge is, of course, we still have this far-left majority on the Montana Supreme Court, but if we get Judge Dan Wilson across the finish line, that can help.
From your lips to God's ears, man, I'm waiting on that. You know, there's a few things that need to happen. The biggest one is we need environmental policy reform bad in this country nationwide. Ultimately, what people were doing 100 years ago is not what we're doing now. It is a clean industry. They operate with the utmost responsibility. And as technology improves, the refinement process of crude is the cleanest it's ever been. It's good. It's abundant energy. We should be utilizing it, and the policy should support that. On the next level, the financial policy, we need tax reform in Montana to benefit industrial growth. And currently, our pipelines are the highest taxed centrally assessed property in our system at 12%. That is a huge investment.
That's one of my biggest questions when it comes to this property tax reform is like, guys, why are we so reliant on residential property taxes? Because we've lost industry. How is raising taxes on industry gonna build back our industrial base and reduce our reliance on residential property taxes? And it's key to this affordability conversation. You raise taxes on the things that we need to be more affordable, you're making them less affordable. On a lighter note, I did an interview with Todd Starnes on Newsmax the other day, and we had a guy from Texas on there with us as well, and I was gonna joke, hey, we got Montana and Texas on the same call here. We got Yellowstone and Landman all wrapped into one. What do your oil and gas guys say about this TV show Landman? I love it.
You know, the best part of this is it doesn't take place in Montana. So, you know, we're not getting the nasty benefits of it. But, hey, you know, my guys love it. It's putting a spotlight on the industry, arguably the most important industry I think we have in this country. Every single person in America fills up their car and they turn their lights on. And we produce that energy. We're proud of it. We work hard. We live in your communities. We fund your schools. And it's nice having a positive light shown on that.
It is. It's a cool show. It's an entertainment. Yeah. Billy Bob Thornton, what a great character. I got to go back to Midland. You know, or I got to go to Fort Worth. By the way, if you think of leaving New York City, you go to Midland or Fort Worth. Montana's close.
It's funny. I was just talking to some buddies over in Williston, and there's some guy driving around in a big jacked up F-350 with an MTEX decal on the side. And that's I don't know if they're filming up there, but maybe they'll leak over to Sydney or something. It'd be kind of funny to see an MTEX oil truck over in Northwest.
Hey, if somebody will give me the pickup, I'll throw an MTEX oil thing on the side.
What the heck?
Sonny Capice, Montana Petroleum Association. Great to see you, my friend. Great insight. Montana Senate President Matt Regeer out of Kalispell. He was on the panel discussion earlier this morning. He'll be with us right after the break. So stand by. Montana Talks live from the Montana Chamber of Commerce Business Days at the Capitol. Back right after this quick break with Senate President Matt Regeer.
This is where Montana Talks at with Lane Nordlund.
As we begin 2026, farmers and ranchers are still asking, will we have a new farm bill in the new year, or will it be delayed another year? Of course, we're currently operating on extensions of the 2018 farm bill. Grower leader Nathan Kane of Montana serves as treasurer of the National Association of Wheat Growers.
You know, 2018, for one thing, the world changed in 2020 with COVID. Everything has become so much more expensive. 2018 farm bill is based on 2012 statistics. So we are so far behind when it comes to what it actual production costs to raise crops now. So like I mentioned before, some of these CR things, the reference price of wheat, we were able to raise that, but it's not through a new farm bill. And honestly, it is really, really difficult to get a farm bill in place. It just is. The political atmosphere right now is just extremely difficult. It's hard to get both parties in line to agree on something. And now where farm bill used to be something that was fairly easier to do and get everyone on board on this, it's pretty difficult right now. And so we're having to go around, well, what are other ways can we do that? And we're able to get some things done through a CR and get that continuing resolution stuff put in place and through the big, beautiful bill put in place. And so that is helpful. But to have a safety net put in place that actually reflects what we're facing right now compared to what it was 2018, 2012 statistics is unbelievably important.
That was Nathan Kane, treasurer of the National Association of Wheat Growers. I'm Lane Nordlund.
Thank you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
Hey, this is great. I was listening in a little bit earlier this morning. I tried to record some of the audio as well. The Eggs and Issues legislative panel discussion, legislative leadership from both sides of the aisle. Let's start. We've got State Senate Minority Whip out of Bozeman, State Senator Pat Flowers. We'll get to him here in just a second. But first, let's start with Montana Senate President Matt Regeer out of Kalispell, first at the table here this morning. Mr. President, good to see you here on the show. Oh, and actually, I realize I got to change my microphone input here for just a second when I take the show on the road. Hopefully, let me try one more thing here. Okay, there we go. All right, Mr. President, I should have you rolling now. Let's see if I got to crank up the audio a little bit. Okay, I got to turn up the audio. Hold on one second.
Hello, good morning.
There we go.
There's a good morning. Good morning, Aaron. Good morning, Montana.
Yeah, listen in a little bit. You gave a great rundown of just the numbers of bills that got through the legislature. Anyway, what do you think was the most interesting information that was shared or discussed or that you want to communicate from the panel earlier this morning?
Oh, boy, there was a lot. There was a lot. We went over all the issues that came. But, yeah, to your point, there were 1,700-odd bills, 1,789, something like that, that got introduced, and 878 bills actually passed both chambers, which ranks it fifth in Montana for bills passed heading to the governor. There was a lot that got done. There was a lot of drama, as you know, too. I mean, we got a senator now that's criminally indicted. I think his court date was yesterday. So, I mean, that kind of drama happened this session. So despite all that drama, there's still a lot of legislation that went through and some good things that got done, some that I wish wouldn't have made it. But here we are. The votes are the votes. And so we can look at the past and talk about it. But then there's also the future. I'm very optimistic about what 2027 holds for the legislature.
Leadership in the Senate side, Pat Flowers, I enjoyed the way you kicked off your comments earlier this morning. You said, well, you know, I'm going to agree on a lot of things, but probably disagree on a few things. But either way, great to have you on the show as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me.
What stood out to you this morning, or what do you want to tell folks all across Montana?
I think there's a lot of good work that got done in this last session that addressed what we've felt were the key issues for Montanans. One, obviously, was property tax, and the property tax relief bill that we passed benefited about 80% of Montanans saw their property tax bill go down. We think that's important. We addressed also through a bunch of different mechanisms child care costs, which are a huge problem for not only individuals but for businesses. We address health care through passing expanded Medicaid, which is important to 75,000 Montanans who rely on that for health insurance, but also really important for rural health care. We address infrastructure needs in the state. Small communities have a tough time addressing things like new wastewater treatment plants. We've created a funding source for that where they can tap into a portion of the funds there to help build their capital stack to get some of those kinds of things done. We addressed partisan courts, which were a big issue, and one that the president and I certainly disagree on, but in my mind that came out to the right place, which is to keep our courts nonpartisan. So those were all important issues to us.
In fact, newly elected Chief Justice Corey Swanson is actually speaking right now, another one of the big keynote speakers here this morning. Senate President Matt Regeer, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so on that one, Pat, you know, I thought up there on the stage, you did a great job of the nonpartisan judges and saying how we want a judge that, I mean, I agree with you on all that, you want a judge that's nonpartisan, that's not going to bring his politics into it, that
he's
going to rule with just a lens through the law and what he should. So I agree with you 100% on that. I just disagree that we have that. We have that already, that there are judges that are hiding behind the cloak of nonpartisan when really they have done a bunch of rulings that are partisan and not, they're taking on the role of the legislative branch when they shouldn't. So, I mean, if I ever am in front of a judge, I want him to rule on a nonpartisan legal basis, too. It's just a matter of, I don't believe we have that today, and that's what needs to change.
Fair enough. That's what you referenced, the robust and important debate that we have in the session, and that's a good example of it.
Yeah.
What's the focus right now during the interim? Because one of the things I think a lot of us, you know, as everyday Montanans out there don't realize, we see the legislature come to town, come to hell, and it's a whirlwind for about 90 days. And then there's elections the next year, and then they're back, and then boom, it's a whirlwind again. But there's actually a lot of work, a lot of things that are being done by legislators in the, you know, outside of the session, just day-to-day stuff, interim committees. Senator Flowers, what's standing out to you in terms of the focus during the interim here?
Well, we have interim committees that cover pretty much every topic that you can imagine, and they're all meeting typically quarterly, and they are in not only fact-finding, but they're also building a legislative agenda for the next session. So each of those committees will come forward with, quote, committee bills, and oftentimes, and hopefully, ideally, those would be some bills that have bipartisan support. Not always, but often they do. So that's important. The specifics of what they're working on, certainly, I think we're going to see more discussion on tax in the next session, as always. I think there's a lot of debate and concern about where we're heading in terms of energy in this state. Obviously, data centers are here. They present, on the one hand, a really great economic opportunity for the state that I think both Republicans and Democrats are interested in. And there are a lot of concerns about the energy demands that come with that. And from our perspective as Democrats, we want to make sure there's a clear firewall between those data centers and ratepayers. So if they come and develop, that they provide their own energy and not come at the expense of ratepayers.
Or pay for their own energy vis-a-vis a co-op or something like that.
Correct.
Yeah, it's interesting how there really is this left-right kind of combination, both in support of the data center economic opportunity, but also a populist kind of very big concern about the data centers as well. We had State Senator Daniel Zolnikov on recently talking about that topic, and I liked how he said, you know, we shouldn't put it shouldn't be paid for on the backs of grandma, and I thought he said that very well. Senate President Matt Regeer, same question to you. Talk about the focus during the interim that's standing out to you.
Yeah, it's I've been doing this since 2017, so a few years, people doing it longer, but it is, I've seen during the interim it increase just steadily by involvement by legislators during the interim year after year, which I think is a good thing. And maybe that your past thoughts on just the legislature versus the exec. I remember when I first got into this, I had some people from departments on the exec saying, oh, we're just waiting until you leave, Matt, and then we take over and we do it. So I think it's a healthy balance to have the legislature more involved during the off season. And with things like the interim budget committees that were put in, Bill Mercer put those in, I believe, in 19, that the Appropriations Committee now is spending more time during the interim looking at budgets and moving forward. It's just a legislative fingerprint on more of state government, which I think is a good thing. It takes more time for citizen legislators to take time out of their careers and come down during the interim, but I believe it's good. It's better governance than what we had when we first.
Then the mad dash of elections,
yes,
in November, caucus elections, and then boom, right to it in January,
right,
and then the budget. Everybody pulls their hair out at the last second or so. Well, gentlemen, great to see both of you here. We'll have to do this again. We really enjoyed during the legislative session. We had Representative Jonathan Carlin from the Democrat side and President Regeer doing a weekly legislative update, and it was a very informative and a fun way to get the word out to our listeners across the state. So appreciate both of you being here today
as
well.
Always great to chat with you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Aaron.
Yeah, Senator Flowers, good to see you as well. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Next up on the microphone, let's see. We've got a listener over there, I think, who just popped in. Bob and Helena. So I'll flag him down during the break to come join us. Chris Averill, my friend Chris Averill, is going to throw on the microphone right now as well. He is, you know, the other big thing here in 2026. The other big thing in 2026 is America's 250th birthday. I am so excited for America's 250th. Chris Averill, you got to be excited as well. You're on the committee.
I am thrilled. Yeah. Thanks, Aaron. Thanks for having me. So
Montana has a commission dedicated to celebrating America this year. And so a lot of people probably haven't heard of us. We're trying to get the word out there. It's called the Montana 250 Commission. It was established by the legislature in 2023. And we're doing a lot of things. We are funding some great programs in communities across the state. We're going to be announcing that this week, that 32 organizations across the state, $400,000 to do a bunch of projects that focus on Montana history, U.S. history, tribal history, events that celebrate America's birthday specific to this year. We're working actively with the Board of Public Education to get a seal of civic literacy approved for high school, graduating high school seniors. They'll have to take the U.S. citizenship test, which the Trump administration just re-upped and sort of enhanced this year. We're working with the Montana Sons and Daughters of Montana Pioneers.
Hold that thought. Quick yes. Break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Hold that thought.
Broadcasting live across the great state of Montana, powered by the Montana Electric Cooperative Association. Your Montana Electric Cooperative, they do much more than keep the lights on for you. This is Montana Talks with Aaron Flint.
All right, we've got Bob from Helena who came down to see us here. He's part of a new group called No Montana Veterans Left Behind. We'll get to Bob here in just a second. I always love it when we're at an event like this, but we also have some of our listeners come down and join us on the show as well. First, though, back to Chris Averill, who is the chairman of the Montana 250 Commission for America's 250th birthday celebrations this year. Chris, I'm very excited that the U.S. Navy's Blue Angels are coming back to Montana this year. To me, that's a official, unofficial, whatever. It's America's 250. Then we got the Blue Angels in Montana. That's incredible. But talk about some of the events that are taking part as the official 250th birthday celebration.
Well, I'm pumped about it, too. And I have a three-year-old who can recognize any military aviation aircraft, which is awesome.
So already.
We're excited about it. We're excited. He just got an aircraft carrier from Santa for Christmas with a Tomcat.
Nice.
But I was talking earlier about some of the educational, because not only do we want to celebrate America, we want to inspire the next generation of Montana leaders and citizens to understand their history, to be proud of their history, and to help shape a better Montana and a better America moving forward. So we're working with the Sons and Daughters of Montana Pioneers on a Montana Challenge, sort of a compendium of Montana history that they can then pass and be part of the seal of civics literacy. We hear a lot from parents who are concerned their kids aren't getting the education they need in civics. I know the Board of Public Ed has worked on that. The legislature has. And the superintendent. So we're working together on that to get kids more engaged in their communities, more engaged with their history. And then we're doing some fun stuff. We're going to have a big public event at the New Heritage Center June 27th. It's a Saturday. The public will be invited. There'll be more details on that. We're working with other states. The great thing about America 250 is every state and territory across the country has a commission. They're all bringing their ideas. Hawaii has a wonderful idea. July 8th at 4 p.m. local, we're going to have synchronized readings of the Declaration of Independence, because that's the time, 6 p.m. Eastern in Philadelphia, it was first read in 1776 to the public. We're planning block parties and community celebrations to have that around the state. July 5th, the Utah folks have come up with the idea of America's potluck. Come together in community and bring your different cultural dishes and show what America's all about.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things we're going to be unveiling and rolling out in the coming weeks and months.
Well, that's great. Well, we'll have to get you back on when we got more time,
because
I'm so excited about America's 250th. You know, my dad played John Adams in the musical 1776 in Montana and 1976 for the 200th, right? So, yeah, now 250th. So I need to get him to try to sing it again for us here on the show. Chris, great to see you. We got a couple minutes left here. Bob Allen, I think, here in Helena. Thanks so much for coming down and joining us on the show. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
Yeah, tell us what's on your mind.
I'm a member of No Montana Veterans Left Behind, a group that's been kind of rolling forward and increasing our membership. We're concerned with our future VA health care and with the bills that have been passed and bills proposed. There hasn't been much feedback from our elected officials on what is really happening.
So when you talk about the concerns with what's happening in the VA, what are some of the specific concerns that you have and want to see addressed in particular?
Well, I think we don't know the ramifications of the big bad bill yet as far as how it's going to influence rural healthcare hospitals and staying open and funding through Medicare, Medicaid, keeping those hospitals open. We got 80,000 vets in Montana, 30,000 of which qualify for some sort of disability. And, you know, potentially we got vets with no local, you know, the blood draw or, you know, and I mean, that's our concern is the future of the VA and, you know, the word on the street, you know, to try to privatize some of our services and abandon some of our legacy hospitals. Doesn't seem like a step in the right direction.
So you'd rather see less of an emphasis on community care and more of an emphasis on the traditional VA clinic structure, VA services?
Absolutely, because right now, like in the Gallatin Valley, or not the Gallatin, but the Helena Valley, St. Pete's and the hospitals, if you are sick and need an appointment, you're months out. And if the VA abandons our services, the vets will be added to the back of the line of local services and put out health care for months, even though, you know, technically it's more convenient.
I was very excited, on a bright note, I was very excited to see there's a brand new VA clinic facility that I think I got to double check and see if it's fully up and running right now, but I saw the flags just got put up on the new facility yesterday, right across, or a couple weeks ago, right across the street from Glacier High School, so that's good to see that.
Excellent. I actually used the facility down in Bozeman for my care, and it's world class, and all veterans need, you know, we need to roll people that way and not toward privatization.
I tell you, I love the folks that the men and women at our VA clinics, you know, we can all, you know, discuss and debate, you know, what the health care looks like or should look like from a bureaucratic standpoint. But I tell you what, the men and women that work in these clinics are just some of the best
world class, and they need to be compensated to keep them in the system.
Well, thanks for your service. 30 seconds to go. Tell us what you did in the Navy.
I was a DP, which was data processing. Doesn't sound that glorious, but it was the height of the Cold War, had a top secret clearance and kind of spy versus spy era.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, thanks for your service, and thanks for coming down and jumping on the microphone.
Super. Thanks.
All right. Good to see you. Tomorrow, I'm going to be broadcasting live from Cut Bank. Hey, if you're going to be in the Cut Bank area, I got to pin down the location. I think we figured out where we're going to be, but I can't tell you yet. But we are going to be in Cut Bank for the show tomorrow, and got some great guests who are going to be joining us as well. So Cut Bank tomorrow, Malta on Friday at the GN. Montana.